Well, shares of Albertsons getting a healthy pop in this session here, up nearly 1.5% after the grocery store chain posted a surprise increase in sales. The company posted revenue of $16.5 billion, a near 5% jump from the same period last year. That growth prompting the company to raise its guidance. Albertsons now expects to earn $2.50 to $2.60 a share for fiscal 2021. Let's bring in the CEO of Albertsons. We've got Vivek Sankaran joining us today. We've also got Yahoo Finance's Brooke DePalma joining in on the conversation. Vivek, it's great to have you on today. Certainly a very strong quarter, the street liking it, but I wonder if we can move the conversation forward. As we've been talking to companies about global supply chain disruptions, I know you're certainly not immune to that. How has that affected Albertsons directly, and how are you shifting up daily operations to make up for some of the supply shortages?
Akiko, good morning, and I'm delighted to be on this. You are right. We are not immune from the supply challenges. We see it, it's spotty. Let me put it that way. The first thing I want to emphasize is it's nothing like we saw during the early days of the pandemic, where we shouldn't be worried we cannot get food and cannot get the items we want. It's just that availability is spotty. And the way we do that, the way we help customers is to make sure that we are always giving people alternatives when they come into that store. You may not find exactly what you want, but you'll find something else. Next week, you might get exactly what you want because a lot of products are on allocation. And that's especially true as we go into Thanksgiving. The other thing we're doing is making sure that we can get product out as soon as we get them. So turkeys are on the shelves already. And so that we can smooth the supply chain out and make sure that consumers feel comfortable that the product is arriving and they'll be ready for the holiday.
Vivek, speaking of that consumer price index jumped 5.4% in the month of September. Now, in this morning's call, you said that inflation is manageable and it's being handled by both region and location. But what sort of impact is Albertsons expecting, and how can customers expect their grocery bills to change in the coming months?
Yeah, Brooke, this time around, I think the one backdrop we have is that we have a consumer that's still strong balance sheets. And so we haven't seen any fundamental change in the behavior of consumers as to what they're buying. We haven't seen a trade down that you would expect to see if in the consumer's wallet's tightening. And so the way we manage those by making sure we give consumers choices. You can always get an opening price point with one of our own brands. You can make trade-offs within protein. Because if something goes up, something else goes going down, and you can make sure you buy that product. I would suggest that I think we're still seeing inflation at a level, at least in food, that is still manageable for the consumer and manageable for companies like us from a gross margin standpoint and the overall profitability standpoint. I suspect that that's going to continue for the next several months.
Vivek, Zach here. It's good to chat with you again. I mean, there's a lot in this report here to celebrate. You guys, same store sales up 1.5% in the quarter. That was well above expectations there. The street had an expectation of a 1.9% decline. So a clear, impressive beat to the upside there. I wonder, though, what has you most excited in terms of how you're differentiating from the competition right now? You've talked a lot about getting consumers to spend more in-store at your guys' grocery stores. Talk about what you're seeing there as you guys continue to take share.
The single metric that we focus on every Monday that I look at is market share gains, both in dollars and in units, because at the end of the day, we sell things that people consume. There's a lot of things working for us. Number one, we focus on everyday execution in our stores, because if that doesn't work, you cannot do much on top of that. And what we've done is put a lot of digital capability on top of that so people can pick it up in a store, in a parking lot, have it delivered at home, delivered in short time frames. And that's helping us. So this combination of having full variety in our store, providing the convenience of delivery and pickup, and having a much bigger fresh mix in our store than others is helping us because you're eating more at home, you're buying more fresh food. And so it's a combination. In summary, the transformation strategy that we're on is working for us, and we've got plenty of headroom left in that in the current plan.
Vivek, transformation was also really the name of the game this quarter. You mentioned that word many times in this morning's call. Now, you also noted that Albertsons' omnichannel consumer is essentially spending three times more than the traditional consumer. So when you look at the roadmap for that digital customer, what exactly is Albertsons expecting in terms of both delivery, loyalty, and ordering online?
Brooke, continued growth on that front. You know, our omnichannel strategy is built around our stores. If you think about over the, in some of our banners, by the way, are over 100 years old, and they've been in, they're in fantastic locations close to where people live. And that's inventory close to where you live. So we're building our omnichannel strategy around those stores. And what you're finding is that there are people who are comfortable with the quality and the assortment that they've seen in the store. And now they know that that same assortment, which by the way is curated for what matters to them in that particular neighborhood, is available either for delivery or for an easy pickup. And I think that creates this virtuous cycle where people are engaging. Now they can go to the store when they want to do a fresh shop or want that experience, and they can take care of things with the convenience of online. That's why we think it resonates so well with people doing both. And when people do both, they just spend more with us. And it clearly means that we're getting market share from somebody else because they're not eating more. And I think there's plenty of headroom as we get better at it and as consumers just get more used to this mode of operating both online and in store.
Vivek, going back to what you discussed earlier about some of the shortages that you're seeing, what are particular products that you're seeing shortages in?
Yeah, Kiko, I'd say we see it in sports drinks, soft drinks. We see it in pet. We see it in frozen. We see it every so often in certain protein categories. And so it is all around the store. We continue to see it in certain laundry and cleaning products. We continue to see it in paper products. My overall message, though, is that it's spotty. It's not a chronic problem where people can't get the supply. It just comes in waves in different categories. And if people are a little patient over a week or a 2 week period, they can always get what they want. It's different from what we saw in the pandemic early days where we were clearly short of certain products and the demand was far outstripping supply.
P&G is out with better than expected earnings this morning, but did warn the inflationary environment remains very challenging. I caught up with P&G Vice Chairman John Mohler to chat about the company's outlook. Worth noting here, Mohler will take over as P&G's CEO on November 1st, succeeding David Taylor. Earnings out, better than expected here, sales up in each of your divisions. What's your read on the consumer right now?
Strong. When we just had our 13th consecutive quarter of volume, sales, consumption, and market share growth, market growth rates across the world are reasonably strong and certainly so in the U.S.
Are you seeing any resistance by the U.S. shopper to some of the price increases P&G has put through?
You know, our business model, which is innovation-based, seeks to build value for consumers through a combination of performance and value. And as a result of that, pricing is a normal part of our business rhythm. Pricing has been a positive contributor to our top line for 44 of the last 47 quarters, for 16 out of the last 17 years. Having said that, the price increases that we've put into the market just recently have only been reflected on shelf for about a month, so it's a little bit early to tell. But I feel good based on the strength of the consumer, the strength of our offerings and their superiority within their categories. We have products available at different price points for consumers with different needs, and a very, very strong innovation program supporting all of that.
You've been at P&G, John, since 1988. You've seen a lot of cycles. I'm not calling you old here. I'm just saying 1988 seems like a long time ago. Is this the worst inflationary backdrop you have ever seen?
If we just look at two components of cost, commodities and transportation, our current forecast is that will be a $2.2 billion after-tax increase versus a year ago. We saw about $600 million after-tax increase in those costs in the quarter that we just completed. So it is a significant inflationary cycle, as opposed to prior cycles, we're in a better place from a product superiority standpoint. We're in a much better place from a cost productivity standpoint. We've built those muscles over the last decade, and those should stand us in good stead as we work our way through the current situation. We see this as a rough patch from a bottom line standpoint for a period of time, but a patch that we should continue to grow through and invest walking forward to opportunities, not stepping back.
You did lift your inflationary outlook. As you mentioned, $2.2 billion. You were at $1.9 billion, if I'm correct. Where is inflation surprising you?
It's pretty broad across the input spectrum. If you, again, just look at different commodities, whether it's commodities that are derived from the petrocomplex, pulp, liner board, et cetera, whether it's gasoline to fuel transportation vehicles. If you look at commodities, generally, they're up anywhere between 50 and 150% versus a year ago. And that's I can paint that story with a pretty broad brush.
There were some, I believe, some recent price increases P&G took in the baby care business this month. Are you looking at any more price increases, just, you know, given how quickly inflation is coming on here?
So we've previously announced price increases in baby care, feminine protection, adult incontinence, home care, and fabric care. We recently just released to the trade news of price increases in our grooming business and parts of our personal care business and in our oral care business. So 9 out of 10 categories in the U.S. have some form of price increase across part of the lineup.
China is a big market for P&G, of course, John. Big there with Head and Shoulders. Have you seen any slowdown in growth in that China market? GDP does appear to be tailing off here.
If we look at consumption within our categories, it continues to grow up 6 to 7% per year. If you look at our results, they're in line with that, up 12% on a two-year stacked basis. Our business in the last quarter was flat versus a year ago, but that has more to do with the timing of big events like Double 11 and the inventory build into that than anything else. Fundamental consumption remains pretty strong and is one of our higher growth markets.
I was joking around with you a little bit, John, before we came on. I remember taping videos with you when I was essentially in a closet, working out of a closet in another place, and you were the CFO of the company. You've touched every position, key leadership position of this company. You become P&G CEO on November 1st. What is your biggest priority when you do take over officially?
Biggest priority is sustaining excellence. Again, I mentioned this is the 13th consecutive quarter of volume, sales, consumption, and market share growth. As part of that, supporting the team. Successful multinational business is not an individual sport. It's a team sport. We have a fantastic team. They've done tremendous work through the pandemic, and I expect them to carry us through to the next chapter.
Before I let you go, how important is ESG to you when you do take the helm of CEO? I found it very interesting that P&G is now going to be tying executive compensation to the progress it does make on ESG. I wish a lot of other executives were doing that out there. You know, how much of a focus is that inside the company?
It's been a focus for a decade or more. All aspects, whether that's governance, our employee representation, and obviously environmental sustainability. It's something our consumers care about. It's something our customers, our retail partners care about. It's something our employees care very much about, and something we're committed to deliver on.
Well, the Milken Conference is going on in Southern California. A number of different folks gathering there to talk economics, markets, policy, for that matter. One of those folks is Scott Meinert over at Guggenheim. He, of course, is the chief investment officer there. Scott, it's always great to talk to you. And what's interesting is, as I looked at some of your recent commentary, your recent notes, I'm seeing a theme that is echoed perhaps elsewhere in the markets, which is you have a lot of concerns about challenges out there, But at the same time, you think stocks can continue to push higher. So explain to me what maybe on the face of it looked like a disconnect.
Sure. Well, you know, it's interesting, and I appreciate you having me, Julie. There's an old saying that bull markets climb a wall of worry. And if that's the case in this situation, we have a big wall ahead of us, which means we can still have a big bull market. But the reason that I'm so positive is there are two things right now. One is there's still a lot of excess liquidity sloshing around the system. The central banks are starting to move toward taper. There's still more money to come. And then the second thing is the seasonal factors. Just around the time of the World Series, which the Dodgers will win this year, the market tends to rally. And so, you know, I did write a commentary a few months back about I was concerned about a pullback that might be related to the economic slowdown from a resurgence in COVID, which I think we did get. Clearly, I think in the last week, the markets have bottomed out. And we're going to see stocks perform very well for the rest of the year and probably into the first half of next year.
Scott, I will not weigh in on the Dodgers. I'm not qualified nor equipped to talk about anything sports related. Maybe the guys can drop into that role. So it sounds like also, as you're talking about this liquidity question, there seems to be a lot of comfort on the part of the market with the tapering. And even with potentially rates going up at some point next year or beyond, do you think it's going to be a rockier process, even though it's well telegraphed, when it actually starts to happen?
Well, I think tapering is pretty much accepted. And if you look at what we went through back in 2018 during the taper up until the fourth quarter, the market continued to rally and perform well. So I don't think taper in and of itself is going to be the catalyst that would be a sell-off. But I do think that we have a slow-moving train coming out of China. The Evergrande situation in and of itself will be contained. I think that the Chinese have that well under control. But the problem is that 20 to 30% of economic output in China is related to property development. And there's a massive overbuilding which has occurred. And, like our housing crisis, they need to work through that inventory. And so while I'm not expecting a crash in prices in China because the market is so controlled and contained, I do think it's going to lead to a substantial economic slowdown. And the impact on that to the region and to the rest of the world at this stage of the game is largely untested and could be like the Asian crisis back in 1997, when the Thai baht was devalued. It really didn't hit our shores until the fourth quarter of 1998, when long-term capital collapsed. So I think this is very similar, and it could be a significant problem for the markets in the second half of next year. But I don't think people are very focused on that time frame right now.
Hey, Scott, it's Brian Chung here. I wanted to ask about whether or not you see leverage being an issue in the United States as well, because we know that the stimulus has enabled a lot of kind of junk credit to thrive in this environment. I mean, what was interesting, I think there hasn't been a single default for a triple C rated issuer in the last 3 months. And the last time we had a streak like that was in 2007. So is leverage stateside also an issue to the degree that maybe you were just describing, at least in China?
Well, it certainly is an issue, Brian, but I think something interesting has occurred in our country in the last year or so, and that is that the Federal Reserve essentially has socialized credit risk. And so if interest rates start to rise and that puts pressure on credit markets, there's a high degree of confidence right now that the Fed is going to step in and stabilize things. That may not happen. They may be tested on this. But I do think that if they do get tested, that there is a reaction function at the Fed where they will take a more active role to contain credit contagion. So I'm not overly concerned about credit right now. And as far as interest rates are concerned, the other big impact of all this debt is it really constrains the Federal Reserve and its ability to raise short-term rates. And our work shows that you really can't push short-term rates much above 2% before it starts impinging upon corporate cash flows. And that is would be negative for credit. So that would pretty much tell us that the top of the cycle will be, for tightening, will be around 2%, which would also mean that the 10-year note would probably be around 2% at the end of the cycle, because historically, the 10-year note is always trading around the same level as overnight rates when the Fed completes its tightening cycle.
Well, from a macro picture, if I could follow up on that, what is the consequence? I mean, if it's okay that these triple C-rated issues, for example, can keep hobbling along, what will the consequences be if the Fed has to tighten maybe at an even faster timeline than what you just outlined? Because if anything, that seems to be the prevailing tail risk here, that if inflationary pressures run amok, then the Fed's going to have to tighten faster and earlier. Could that pop a bubble? Could that kill some zombie companies and really create a mess?
Well, I don't think so. Again, because I think they're going to be very constrained. Obviously, we're going to lose some companies as the Fed starts to raise rates. The question is will it become systemic? And that's the point where the Federal Reserve is going to have to intervene. The policies that we've established in the era after the great financial crisis really have tied the Fed's hands. And so, the Fed is basically responsible for the market now, a role that it wasn't designed to do when it was created in 1914. But the evolution of central bank policy has been to keep expanding its role in supporting the economy. And one of the things it'll have to do to support the economy is let inflation go if it has to in order to stabilize the credit situation and risk assets.
And Scott, if the Fed has in fact socialized policy, as you mentioned here, what is the risk to global markets, bond markets, stock markets, you name it, if the Biden administration doesn't reappoint Jay Powell's Fed chair?
I don't think it's going to matter very much. I think Chairman Powell, will lean toward the dovish side anyway. Clearly Secretary Yellen would like to see him reappointed. I doubt that's likely now in the wake of what's happened and the issues with Elizabeth Warren. That probably means Lyle Brainard will be front and center. Lyle Brainard is a dove, and the president is going to get to do four appointments within the next year at the Federal Reserve, and he has a great opportunity to appoint people. And I think, given the pressures from the populist side of the party, that he's going to have to basically appoint people who are in favor of easy money.
And so then what is that going to mean for policy, Scott?
Well, I mean,
continued easy money, I guess.
The dirty little secret is, we are already doing MMT. We don't call it MMT, but let's face it, the government, the central bank is financing the government as the stimulus pulls back, which it is right now. The likelihood of a stimulus package today looks to be in the neighborhood of $1.5 trillion on top of the infrastructure package. That's going to take a lot of pressure off the Treasury market for supply, new supply, and so the Fed will be able to pull back without having interest rates spike. But the minute we're in trouble again, the Fed has appointed itself as the guardian of the economy, and it's going to intervene to do whatever it has to do.
Well, we'll be looking for those personnel changes and other changes potentially over the next year or so. Scott, thanks so much. It's always great to catch up with you. Be well. Scott Meinert is Guggenheim Chief Investment Officer.
Norwegian robotics company AutoStore appears to have wowed the street in the lead up to its IPO. AutoStore said today it has priced its IPO at the top of its targeted range, valuing the company at about $12.4 billion. It's not hard to understand the investor enthusiasm. AutoStore is a major player in warehouse automation technology At a time where companies are aggressively growing online and need tech like this to compete. Joining us for more on the company is AutoStore President and CEO Carl Lier. Carl, good to see you this morning here. Congrats on the debut. For those folks out there not familiar with what you do, what are some of the drivers of your business right now?
Well, we are a robotics company in the automatic robotics business. So we automate warehouses, among others. We see after the pandemic that the growth in e-commerce really has accelerated this business. And we have seen very strong growth, really for many years. But after the pandemic, really, the demand has increased very, very strongly.
And Carl, it's Julie here. So talk to us about where the demand is coming from. It's kind of interesting to me that your technology is not even more widespread given the growth we had already seen in e-commerce. Where is the demand coming from, and what do you think is the growth path for your company and its technology?
Well, we are in the ASRS business, and this market is primarily manual operation today. We say that 15% of the market is penetrated with automation. We believe that during the next decades, probably 75 to 80% of the warehouses will be automated, and that brings a market that will grow strongly for really decades to come. In addition, our product is very strongly linked with e-commerce. 70% of our customers are into e-commerce. So the growth, the secular growth drivers like e-commerce, change in trading patterns, et cetera, is also accelerating our business.
And Carl, one number that jumped off to me on the presentation that you all put out, $3.4 billion product pipeline, over 2,000 projects in the works. How long does it take until you realize that amount of revenue?
Well, we see that a lot of these we say that slightly more than 10% will materialize during 12 months, for instance, and there will be some delays, and a lot will take longer time. So we see really project lifetimes of from 3 months to 3 years, I would say.
Hey, Carl, Brian Chung here. This is a bit of a silly question, but obviously there's a shortage of auto parts out there. This is kind of in line with just the broad supply chain issues in many other industries as well. But does that affect your ability to source the parts that you use to build up your factories? Obviously, with this IPO, you're building up capital. I imagine you're using that for a growth strategy to maybe increase what you've got going on here. What does it take to put these robots and the infrastructure together, and is it hard to build that right now?
Well, I will say that generally, I think all over the world, there is challenges on the sourcing side. We have seen it this year, primarily with longer lead times on aluminium, I would say. But we have been able to deliver the expected volumes and customer demands for 2021 and are increasing capacity for 2022 on the aluminium side. But there are longer lead times, so customers need to order the projects earlier to secure delivery at the right time. In addition, you have components where it is allocation at the moment. And in that connection, we have been able to continue to deliver as expected during 2021. And we work hard every day to continue to deliver the growth also for going forward.
How is the chip supply shortage impacting the business, Carl?
Well, at the moment, we have been able to deliver according to expectations, and we are working with the component sourcing all the time, really, to secure deliveries. As we see it now, we are on track to continue to deliver the growth also for 2022.
All right, we'll leave it there. AutoStore President and CEO Carl Lier, congrats on the IPO. We look forward to staying in touch.
Lisa Ellis, Moffitt-Nathanson, a senior equity analyst, joining us once again on the show. And Lisa, of course, we bring it back in because before we were talking about it when it went public, you called it a must-own stock. And now a lot of different things to chat about when it comes to Coinbase. A lot of people talking today about the partnership with Facebook to work on their wallet. But now, I mean, I suppose you got your plethora of choices to choose why you could be so bullish on it now. So what does it all mean for Coinbase?
Yeah, there's a lot going on right now with Coinbase. Very excited to see it back above $300. Took us a little while to get there, I guess. But yeah, there's a lot going on. There's their NFT marketplace is a big news. Their recently announced partnerships with both Facebook and with the NBA. Big news as well. Of course, the implications of the ProShares ETF, and then also the, you know, the ongoing back and forth between Coinbase and the SEC related to the regulatory framework around crypto. All of these things just in the last, I'd say, you know, 10 days or so. So a lot going on, very exciting. I mean, I have to say, just to sort of set it up right back in April or May when we saw the last peak in Bitcoin and everyone was anticipating that we'd go into the next, you know, crypto winter, so to speak. You know, we were expecting, and I think many were, a far steeper and more protracted decline in crypto assets, more akin to what we saw back in 2017, 2018, where they dropped, you know, 60% peak to trough. And for 9 months, it lasted like that. So the fact that we're actually back here above 60,000, you know, only, you know, 6 or 7 months later it's actually a really positive outlook for the overall crypto ecosystem. So yeah, good stuff and a lot going on.
You could expect, I suppose, by extension, that Coinbase would be trading a bit higher, too, as Bitcoin comes back to its all-time high. Last I checked, you have a $600 price target on Coinbase. I mean, I was also kind of shocked to see 1.5 million customers waiting for their NFT product here. It's more than I think OpenSea has, if everybody does sign up. And that's a whole nother revenue track for them versus just the trading fees. So, I mean, when you piece it together, is 600 still the target that people should be expecting if all this continues, this momentum continues?
Yeah, we're sticking with our $600 price target. That's a revenue multiple based off of 2023 revenues. And if anything, honestly, since we set that target back in April at the IPO, they've only beat the numbers since then, honestly. The market is still trying to figure out, I'd say, how to handle Coinbase because of the volatility in the business that's so linked to the volatility in the underlying crypto assets. The market doesn't quite know how to handle that. But certainly, if you're a longer-term investor, if you can hold something for 2 to 3 or more years, this is a absolute no-brainer in our view. And the NFT marketplace is a good example of that. Our forecasts for Coinbase are only currently based off of the existing base brokerage and exchange business. Mm-hmm. We don't make, you know, sort of arbitrary hand adjustments for these future streams of services, but the company is certainly rolling out loads of them. And the NFT marketplace is a great example of that with $1.5 million, you know, folks already on the waiting list. Interestingly, you know, NFTs, I think, is an area where it's still a bit of an ambiguous part of the crypto ecosystem. But I was speaking recently with the head of crypto at Visa. And interestingly, he was commenting that their view and the view out, you know, in that there in the Silicon Valley world is that NFTs really should be thought of as the next generation of e-commerce, that NFTs will enable digital based commerce of, you know, intangible goods, much in the same way that e-commerce unleashed, you know, the flow of physical goods in a very new way, that they really think of it as very similar to that in terms of unlocking economic growth at a whole nother level. So very exciting to see Coinbase rolling out their NFT marketplace.
Yeah, as we've highlighted on the show, too, we've seen the NFT technology move beyond just digital art now into a lot of different space, whether it be tickets or fashion, even as we've spotlighted. But I guess, you know, let me throw a different question at you here, because some people watching this might say, well, if all the enthusiasm's here around the Bitcoin ETF, people can go out and buy that. Why do you need Coinbase anymore? I would say that might be short-sighted when it comes to all the other altcoins out there that Coinbase offers. But what is maybe the dynamic there between all the different on-ramps being built out and the threat maybe that it poses for Coinbase being the original on-ramp for a lot of people here in the U.S.?
It's a very legitimate question, how ETFs will affect Coinbase and the direct purchasing of crypto assets is still a little bit TBD. On one hand, investing in crypto is still so new that having access to ETFs and just different types of exposure
should just broaden out the interest and mainstreaming of crypto investing. And there's still huge runway in that, right? Like, total value of crypto assets today is sitting, you know, somewhere between $2-3 trillion. The total AUM of things like gold or other commodities, real estate, you know, all these other alternative investments is more like 10 to 12 trillion. So we've comfortably got a, 5X scaling before we achieve some of those other alternative asset classes. But it's an important dynamic, because it's a good question as to whether the mainstream investor is going to just start buying ETF exposure to crypto and not outright own crypto assets through like a Coinbase wallet, which would potentially be a negative. Okay. To offset that, what we're hoping to see more of from Coinbase is things like the partnership they're doing with Facebook, where increasingly Coinbase plays like the underlying custody role, providing the underlying infrastructure for buying and selling crypto assets to institutions, as well as their retail business directly to consumers.
And we're already seeing that with the news of the Facebook partnership as well. So some of that already coming true. We'll see how it all moves forward. Exciting times. Lisa Ellis, Moffitt-Nathanson, Senior Equity Analyst, appreciate you coming back on. Keep us posted if that price target does change.
Now we're going to pivot from planes to hot dogs right now. Much-loved Chicago dog restaurant Portillo's is about to take off on the NASDAQ under stock ticker PTLO. And to talk all about this, we are joined by CEO and President Michael Osanloo. Michael, it's great to have you on the program today. 67 restaurants in 9 states, all profitable. You're shipping to 50 states as well. First of all, congratulations on the debut that's going to be happening today. What is the game plan for your capital raise in terms of expanding the company and what you've already built?
Well, first, thank you for having me on. It is a super exciting time for all of us at Portillo's. And as you highlighted, right, it's all about growth for us. We are, you know, while we're a 58-year-old company, we're still infants when it comes to our growth inflection point. We think there's well over 600 restaurants across the U.S., and that's what our capital is all about. It's about growing across a very strong foundation that we have in the Midwest, and then it's growing very strategically across the Sun Belt in states like Arizona and Florida, and especially Texas, where there is a lot of latent pent-up demand for Portillo's.
Michael, why are folks so obsessed with your hot dogs? What's the secret ingredient there?
Oh, I can't tell you that, but I can tell you that if you try it, you will understand. I mean, I think, you know, in all seriousness, it's just an amazingly high quality product, right? The hot dog is wonderfully made. The 7 ingredients that make it a Chicago style dog. We have a culinarian on our team who is a sommelier and has worked at Michelin star restaurants. He thinks it's the best food in America. That combination of textures and flavors and sweet and spicy, honestly, I got my own mouth watering here talking about it. So the Chicago-style dog, it's magical.
When are you, any plans to come out with breakfast?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Any plans to come out with a breakfast offering?
You know, it's funny. It's probably the biggest complaint our Chicago customers have is that we do a pepper and eggs sandwich during Lent. And we have folks lined up in our drive-thrus, outside our doors, in the morning, and then it's just for a limited time period. So I get a lot of let's call it strong suggestions to do breakfast in Chicagoland. It's something we'll seriously consider down the road.
Mike, I want to apologize for my coworker there. I think it's just because it's 10:45 that he's thinking about that right now. But to kind of pivot, where are your markets of focus? Obviously, in the Chicago area, the brand is well-known, well-loved. Are there certain parts of the country that you feel like might be great places to expand to? And then secondly, what is the distribution model? Are you prioritizing more of the drive-thru versus people sitting in and dining out? I know COVID has shaken things up, but what is the model for what you would like your expansion to look like?
Yeah, it's a great question. We are going to grow in markets where we think that there is structural tailwind behind us. So population growth in the United States, the 3 fastest states growing are Arizona, Florida, and Texas. No secret, we're going to grow there. We know that we ship our food to Florida, Arizona, and Texas. Texas happens to be the number one place where we ship our food to, and we're going to open a flagship restaurant in the Dallas suburbs next year. So you're going to see a lot of Portillo's growth in the core of the Midwest. Michigan is a priority for us. Ohio is a priority for us. But also across those three states along the Sun Belt. We think that building in places where there's population growth, that, you know, there's a great labor structure, et cetera, is a really good idea for our guests, our team members, and our investors.
And Michael, this isn't your first rodeo. You used to lead P.F. Chang's. Is this the most challenging labor market you have ever seen in your career?
Yeah, I don't think anybody, I think it's hard to put to words what goes on in the labor market. I will tell you that I think we have done a smart job in mitigating some of the impact of this, because we think of you know, the labor as our people. And I think they're our biggest asset. And I personally believe in a form of enlightened capitalism. So during COVID, for example, we did not lay off or furlough a single person, not one person. In fact, what we did is we doubled down. We invested in our team members. We paid them bonuses. We took great care of our people. And so in return, what we're seeing is better than industry turnover, incredible productivity out of our team members. And I think those people who treat their frontline team members as human beings and take great care of them are starting to differentiate themselves in this labor market.
Michael Sanlu, CEO and president of Portillo's, thanks again for hopping on, and congratulations again on your big day.
It was interesting, third quarter out of appliance king Whirlpool. The company's profits beat analyst estimates on the back of continued strong demand in North America. Whirlpool lifted its full-year earnings outlook by 25 cents, and it jacked up its longer-term sales growth and operating margin targets. But the stock is under a little pressure here, as third quarter sales were held back by the industry's supply chain bottlenecks. Let's dissect all of this with Whirlpool Chairman and CEO Mark Bitzer. Mark, always nice to see you. I know you're fresh off your earnings call, and my takeaway from the call was this. I still don't think people understand how maniacal Whirlpool is about cost management, and, or as you call it, cost out. And you have the ability to overcome high periods of inflation. What are you doing right now to overcome that inflationary hit, which is still looking like $1 billion this year?
Yeah. So, Brian, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. You know, let me first zoom out on inflation. You know, we guided towards significant inflation already with our Q1 earnings call. We pretty much kept it constant. So, which, knock on wood, we basically read the signs the correct way. Now, it is significant inflation, but at least we were not surprised. And as such, in Q3, we actually dealt with 6.5 points of inflation in our P&L. And yet the bottom line was not impacted at all. We delivered 11.1% operating margin. So we feel really, really good how we've been able to deal and mitigate inflation, not only in this quarter, but in all the previous quarters. Now, obviously, how you deal with that is a combination of you still double down on all the other cost levers you have, which, of course, in an inflation environment is tough. And on top of that, we have significant pricing progress, you know, we started that journey already last year, which is a combination of less promotional pressure, list price increases throughout the world. So I would say the combination of strong pricing coupled with aggressive cost takeout allowed us to completely mitigate these massive inflation challenges.
Hey, it's Brian Chung here. Now, Mark, when we talk about the macro picture, the big story has been kind of this T word, the idea of transitory, that some of these supply chain issues are just something we're dealing with right now and they'll abate at some point. But you're a company that's trying to offer guidance to your analysts and to your investors. I understand James Peters was saying that your guidance for the full year, you do believe to be on the low end. But how difficult is it to forecast where you see things going and when you'll expect to be able to meet the orders that you have that's building up on your backlog?
Yeah, so Brian, given that you mentioned the T word, I guess it shows people have different definition of a transitory. You know, I'm not quite sure how long you would define transitory these days. I mean, I think the real question is, do we see a expected cyclical inflation or does it turn into a structural inflation? I don't think it's the latter one personally. But I think with inflation environment, we will see around us for some time. It's not going to go away overnight. And we're prepared to deal with that. Now, to your other question about how difficult it is to give guidance, yeah, it's always challenging. I guess a company of our size wouldn't get away with a kind of guidance margin of error, as you mentioned in the early example earlier on the show, it's of course challenging. But I would say even this year, we've been able to predict the key drivers fairly well. Now, the elements which are always a little bit unpredictable is the supply chain constraints. It really makes it hard to predict frankly, month to month in terms of how much can you actually dial up a production. And I think that's probably the biggest uncertainty which we still have. We made progress in Q3, frankly, not as much as I wanted, but we made progress in kind of starting to increase more and more and resolving some of these order backlogs.
Mark, it's Julie here. What exactly needs to happen? Where are the worst bottlenecks or worst points of tension? And what are you going to be looking for? And what should we as consumers and as people who watch the finance and business world be looking for as signs that things are loosening up a little bit?
You know, Julie, first of all, we got to recognize there's not a single source issue which explains a lot of supply constraints. You know, if I break it down three major pieces, there is structural labor shortage. It is fairly widespread, in particular in North America. I don't think necessarily it's a reflection of wages. We actually increased our wage at double digits last 12 months. So we certainly dealt with that part of the equation. But you have labor shortage. That's one. Two, you still have significant component issues and challenges with suppliers who basically face the same labor shortages in other elements. Obviously, the most prominent one is the chip supply, but it's not the only one. And the third element is transportation bottlenecks, both on the big ocean freight inbound, which affect, of course, a lot of parts. But even domestically, it just takes you a whole lot longer to get your products from Clyde, Ohio to California. So put that all together, these are fundamentally still the drivers. What I still would like to highlight, we produced in Q3 more than we did last year Q3 and more than Q3 19. So we're dialing up production, which leads me to the positive things. Ultimately, Matt, what people lose sight when we talk about all the shortages and the sky is falling, whatever. Why do we have shortages or availability issues? Because the demand is strong. The demand outpaces our ability to increase production. So is it painful because we don't want to have consumers waiting? Yes. Could we have invoiced more? Yes. But structurally, it's a positive sign and reaches a positive sign, but demand is very, very strong.
Mark, I also know that you all have been raising prices as a result of all of this. How much more price do you expect to take? And even though demand is robust, are you seeing any kind of demand destruction or pushback on price increases?
Yeah, so Julie, so far we haven't seen it, frankly. As you know, I can't make a comment on go-forward pricing. But I think in the past, the consumer reaction on this one was close to zero. So there's, you know, what we all refer to as category price elasticity. How sensitive is consumer demand to the overall category pricing? It's very, very limited. Typically, what you see, Mary, is more kind of a promotional pressure out there in the market, which explains a lot of the moves. But no, we did not see a slowdown of the demand. Which leads me to the second point, and I think you implied in this one, is, you know, some people, not you guys, but some people were referring to demand pull forward. I would exactly argue the opposite. What we've seen through COVID is a significantly increased usage of appliances. And to give you some real numbers, you know, we pretty much have the largest installed base of connected appliances out there, several hundred thousand. So we can exactly measure appliance usage pre-COVID, post-COVID. On freestanding ranges and ovens, we see more than 2x the usage. Washers, 27% up. And we don't expect that to radically come down because, you know, in a hybrid work environment, people will spend more days at home. So that is the fundamental driver why we do expect replacement demand in particular because of higher wear and tear to be very strong going forward. And that gives us a lot of confidence.
Yeah, Mark, you're on the mark. You're on the mark here that you've seen a tremendous spike in demand this year, and that will likely lead to really a higher replacement cycle. Can you find the workers in the U.S. to build these products? I mean, are you having worker shortages at all?
Yeah, so Brian, I mean, you raise an issue with this. We feel it. And frankly, you know, it's, first of all, to set the context, we are a U.S. producer. More than 80% of what we sell in the U.S. is produced in the U.S. That's higher than anybody else because we believe in U.S. production. We have more than 20,000 people just in the factories. So, of course, immediately after COVID, the kind of, you know, people coming to work, it's just the absenteeism increased, which for all the understandable reasons, people were concerned, etc. It slowly kept coming back. But frankly, we carried several hundred job openings from Q1 to Q2 and Q3. It's slowly getting better. As I mentioned before, we significantly adjusted the wages more than at any time before. It's slowly getting better, but worker shortages, or call it workforce participation, starts becoming a concern, particularly for a big producer like we are.
It has been a heck of a 18 months. Whirlpool Chairman and CEO Mark Bitzer, always good to see you. Looking forward to your Investor Day. Have a great weekend.